What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Western history has led us to the most prosperous age in the history of humanity, and yet more and more our kids are taught to be ashamed of their country. Are you tired of Common Core, Howard Zinn-influenced revisionist history in our schools? Do you want your family to have fun learning about history that you can trust? Do you want your kids to learn to love history? Then DriveThruHistory.com is for you. The guys over at DriveThruHistory.com have created a world of entertaining, on-location, video-based courses for your kids. They've got ancient history, American history, biblical history, and world history. Perfect for all of you who find yourself homeschooling for the first time. It's fun, and your kids are going to love it. To learn more, head over to DriveThruHistory.com/Zuby, Z-U-B-Y, where they've got streamed courses and old-school DVDs, and you can use the code Zuby, Z-U-B-Y, at checkout for 20% off any order. That's DriveThruHistory.com/Zuby. Go check it out.
I am the man, sick with the slang, sick and I'm destined for fame. Do for the fam, not for the grand, stunt me, you're destined for pain. I do not front, I do not scam, put some respect on my name. Sick like Obain, click and I bang, y'all gon' remember the name. Y'all gon' remember the name.
What's up, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls around the world? I would like to welcome you back to the Real Talk with Zuby podcast. On today's episode, we have got on an author, a podcaster, host of the weekly Dumpster Fire show on YouTube as well. And she's a comedian. And this is Bridget Fettesy. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Most welcome. So Bridget, for the people out there who don't know you, tell them a little bit about who you are and what you do.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, I write and I have a podcast, as you mentioned, and I now have a show on YouTube, Dumpster Fire, that just kind of makes fun of the dumpster fire that the culture is, and particularly in America, in American politics right now, as you've commented on. And I also am writing a book, and I'm just, I do stand-up comedy when you're allowed to, mm-hmm. when stages are open. And I really just like being creative and I started a company many years ago and it went bankrupt. And then I have it's in kind of its second evolution. I never really gave up on the dream. I mean, my story's long and weird. I am sober. That's a huge part of my story and what I talk about regularly. And I'm a big proponent of taking control of that which you can and knowing, you know, how to stay in your own lane and take care of yourself and recognizing the areas in which you're kind of powerless. So I think you and I really see eye to eye on getting out of the victimhood mentality and really taking control and personal responsibility. And I had a long history with feeling like a victim. So okay. I have a lot of experience of getting out of that mentality.
Mm. So, I mean, wow, there's a lot. Yeah, there's a lot there. Yeah, there is a lot there. So I'm somewhat familiar with, so as someone who knows you, I'm a little bit familiar with your background and having seen some of your previous interviews and things like that. I know you're open and you've talked about that stuff a lot. So as someone who has, I mean, can you give a little bit of a background story? I mean, it's interesting to know, given where you are now, of course, there's a whole history behind it. There's a whole sort of life story behind it all. So could you give a somewhat abbreviated version of that to give some context?
I can do my best. So I guess the best, you know, if you were to ask me what my role, somebody introduced me as a media personality, which I think is probably the correct, although maybe not my favorite title, but that almost happened accidentally, which is the book I'm writing about. And a lot of it is because I was raised very liberal in my upbringing. I come from a big family, Irish Catholic, East Coast, and we were very much like the old school kind of Democrats. You know, that my grandmother, I always joke, worshipped Kennedy and Jesus like equally and alcohol. And I just never really questioned that paradigm ever. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've kind of mentioned this before, just the idea of factory settings and having these things that are put in your brain, just it's really the nurture that you're raised with. Mm-hmm. And I never questioned it. And I kind of barreled through life. And I was a very high achieving student. We moved every year and a half. And then I kind of gave up on myself at a certain point, and I started partying a lot, and I wanted to just fit in with wherever I went. I was tired of just being the new girl, and I knew that if I adopted this party girl persona that I would have just an automatic group of friends no matter where I went. Mm-hmm. And I lost myself very young and ended up in rehab at age 19 for a heroin addiction. Okay. I got sober, but I didn't stay sober. Mm-hmm. I never used heroin again because I convinced myself that that was the problem, which I see now as a fatal error in my judgment. Mm-hmm. And then I continued on, and I really lost years of my life in alcoholism. I was married to a Belarusian. I was waiting tables. Around the age of 19, right after I got out of rehab, when I was sober for a little, there was a little window, I really realized that I was a creative person and wanted to move to LA or New York and pursue a creative path. And probably acting was what I came to LA for originally, but it was like breathing to me. Mm-hmm. So I didn't even think that I could be a writer. It was just something I did. So I lived in through my 20s. I came out to LA right after rehab, basically. And then I was here for 2 years and left and went back east. It's a lot of family drama and a long story. But I ended up spending many years in this restaurant industry rut, feeling like there were certain things that happened that were out of my control that made me feel very entitled to feeling like a victim.
Okay.
Some of which I've talked about, some of which I don't know that I'll ever talk about. And sure. I was really just stuck in my own stuff. It was like my wheels were spinning in the mud, and so much of it now I see is just alcoholism. I couldn't get out of my own way, and smoking weed, and I was still doing some other drugs, just not heroin. And then around 27, 28, I'm kind of that classic alcoholic, and in the literature and 12-step programs, they'll talk about how you try to do literally everything other than quit drinking. So I found a therapist. I became certified in yoga. I quit drinking and only smoked weed. You do all these things. And I did all that. And then I ended up starting my company at 26.
Okay.
And I was on my way out of my first marriage. It just wasn't working. We were very young. I was 23 when I got married this time. Mm-hmm. And I left and came back to LA, basically. And we got separated. I came out to LA and I just had wreckage. I had wreckage with my family. I had wreckage. I had a marriage. My to-do list was like, go bankrupt, get divorced. And I had no money. Yeah. And it was just, I had felt like I was a failure. And I had failed. I mean, I failed miserably when I was 19. And I really have been looking at a lot of this lately. I don't think I ever forgave myself for that first failure. And I thought I was so old at 19. And I will say this to anyone young listening right now who might be feeling like, oh, I wasted my time. I'm 23. Oh, I messed up and I'm 25 and I went and my life went in a different direction. You are young, like so incredibly young. And it's never really too old to turn around your life. I know people in their 70s who have got sober and or changed their life. And I thought I was just so old at 19 and I never forgave myself for that initial mess up. And I think I carried it with me through my 20s. And I got sober. I did an experimental year of sobriety around the age of 30. Okay. And then that kind of changed the way drinking was for me forever. However, then I went around the world for 2 years just traveling around the globe, not sober. Lucky I didn't end up in locked up abroad. Mm-hmm. And I should have. And then I came back and I was very lost and got sober at 35. So that was almost 7 years ago now. And so much of everything, even as I'm talking to you, I realize really centers around that addiction and alcoholism and just the kind of long struggle that I had with it, not really even realizing that I was struggling with it. Mm. Because for years, I was just like, I got this. I refuse to go back. I'm not giving up drinking. And it took me a long time. The bottom that I hit at 35 was much more emotional. It was more internal. And what I realized was that I it was a spiritual bottom. I just had bottomed out. I had experienced the physical bottom at 19. I had lost all kinds of things. I lost my health when I was 19. I lost a job, my college. Materially, I had bottomed out probably more than once. I had been divorced and now bankrupt. But what hit me at 35 was something much deeper inside. And I was suicidal, basically. I really just didn't want to live.
Yeah.
So that brings me to finding my way weirdly into the culture wars, which was I got sober and then I started doing all the things I wanted to do, one of which was writing. And I was a columnist for Playboy.
Okay.
And
so before we go on, there's something you said there that I wanted to go a little bit deeper on is you said you had that you hit the emotional bottom and that was a transition point. How did you get yourself out of that hole?
I went back to a 12-step program and I got sober and I really surrendered. And I had been very anti 12-step. I wasn't just like, oh, if it works, good for them. I had a lot of issues with them, which I understand now makes sense, being that I didn't want to get sober. But I had a lot of issues and I thought it was fear-based and all this stuff. And I have come to see that there's something for me, and I think there are many ways to find that spiritual center, but for me, it's so rooted in, you know, I come from Catholicism, so I had a lot of issues around God.
Okay.
Just growing up with it's just I came in, I call myself a recovering Catholic too. There were just it wasn't scripture has helped so many of my friends and so many people I know ground their life in it. And I do to a certain degree, but more than anything, what I love about the 12 steps is that it's grounded in service and this kind of idea. I mean, the genius of that program is that someone had the foresight to say God or God as you understand him, whatever your concept is, because so many people have baggage around and they realize that it was a block to people getting sober.
Okay.
And that was just that willingness to accept really anybody. And whatever, for me, when I first came in, I had such a hard time with the concept. My sponsor was like, I don't care what it is. It can be the group. It just can't be you. And so I made it dogs because it was God spelled backwards and they're everywhere.
Every time
they just represent what I really want out of a higher power, which is loyalty and being present in the moment and joy and just companionship, feeling like they're always there. And they have such a huge presence, these animals. It's crazy. So that was it for me. I mean, it was that simple. It's expanded a lot in the 7 years, but that was the door that I walked through. Okay. And being of service. I mean, I was already waiting tables, but I was so bitter about the fact that I was waiting tables. And yeah. Then I got sober and I realized that it was an opportunity to literally be of service. That was my job, was a server. And once I made that shift mentally and being sober and not hungover and waiting to get off my shift and all these things, it became such a joy to wait tables. It suddenly just, it's amazing how something that I did for almost 20 years was, it was just so revealing to me about how perspective truly is everything. That I had done that job for years and felt miserable and resentful, and then got sober and shifted the way that I perceived the job. And it was a joy and I was honored to be doing it.
Gotcha. No, that's powerful. And so from there, I know you started writing at Playboy after this, and then everything else followed. Is that correct?
Yes. So okay. I was always trying to write. I wrote a column in my hometown when I was in the dark years, as I was calling them, back in my 20s and alcoholism and married. But that was the most I'd ever been paid for. And it was $50 a column. Mm-hmm. And I caused all kinds of problems in my that should have been a sign, actually, of things to come. Yeah. And then I wrote a column for Playboy, and then they hired me to write a regular one. And I did that starting in 2015. But that was when, just putting myself out there and writing, the world had changed so much and I was not very online. So suddenly I was exposed to the culture wars, and things had changed a lot with the millennials from, I'm Gen X. Mm-hmm. So even just things like feminism and all of the I did not know. I mean, I knew nothing. Nothing. I knew nothing of critical theory. I had knew nothing. I knew nothing. Yeah. I was like a baby seal that was in unleashed into shark infested waters that have been domesticated. It was truly like I came out of a blackout, literally into the culture wars. Not that that's an excuse, you know, I'm not saying I was ignorant and that I'm excused by that, but man, the learning curve has been extremely steep and very public. You know, I've had to publicly acknowledge how much of a moron I am over and over again. It's very humbling.
That's interesting. So, I mean, how did you even get involved in this world? I say this as someone else who has sort of reluctantly been dragged kicking and screaming from my sort of main primary career that people certainly used to know me for as a musician to sort of becoming some type of cultural, socio-political commentator and podcaster and frequent podcast guest and all, you know, just someone who's involved in this whole conversation. So I know how I ended up in it, but how did you end up there? What was the first
Twitter
thing Twitter. Okay. Okay.
I mean, really it was Twitter. It was because I was doing stand up as well. And I just noticed that I was self-censoring.
Okay.
And I'm a comedian. I'm not supposed to censor anything. And I was not saying things about the left that I wanted to say. And it was like, huh, that's interesting. And then I realized that it was because there was this whole climate of silencing and fear and cancel culture. And, you know, when I see these things like The Letter going out now, and I mean, good for it, but welcome, you know, welcome to what I've been. It's frustrating from someone on the left because I'm not like a academic or considered somebody who's, I don't have the credentials to be taken very seriously, but a lot of the stuff that they're writing about, many of us in the left have been screaming for 5 years now. Mm-hmm. And I'm so glad to see that it's kind of jumping mainstream, because I think, as Claire Lehman from Quillette has said before, we have to share the risk. So really, I reluctantly got dragged into this just by not being quiet, which is a challenge for me. And so I just started saying things that I stopped censoring myself really in any way that I might have been. And it's easy to go after Trump if you live in LA. It's not so easy to go after anyone on the left.
Yeah.
And if you're in my, and I know that it comes with a certain amount of risk. I remember definitely the moment where I sat down and had to say, this might cost me some of my dreams. And, you know, I might not be able to work in a writer's room, for example, because the other writers might be on Twitter and they might say, oh, she interacts with Ben Shapiro and I don't feel safe.
How dare you?
Or whatever. Yeah, I know.
The I don't feel safe thing is so jarring. The whole like the language that gets used, like the safety and trauma and harm and violence. I'm like, look, stop misusing every single word that.
Yeah.
That exists and is supposed to have a real meaning. It's so, I don't know. It's so, what's the word?
It's terrifying. It's unsettling.
Yeah. It's just so overhyped.
Yeah. But it's also deeply unsettling and in ways that I can't really always articulate because it's so insidious. Mm. My ex-husband is much better at articulating this because he comes from Belarus and communism. So he is very able to identify what is happening and in a way that I think is why I feel so unsettled by it. And then even just rereading 1984, seeing it, and you see these, you know, like the Office of Diversity and Inclusion, you're like, what the? And by the way, once you set, my friend and I were talking about this the other day, once you set up an anti-racism, you know, task force, you can never disband that. If you have that at your college, for example, there was an article yesterday, 2 days ago that came out about how their English is racist. Grammar is racist.
Of course.
Did you see this?
Yeah. Everything's racist. Everything. Logic, science, clear thinking, individuality, all of it. It's all whiteness. It's disgusting.
Yes. I know.
Nuclear family. Crazy.
Yeah. That's weird. And it's this, like, I don't feel safe language is used as kind of this cudgel to silence people. And you can basically say, I don't feel safe and get anybody kicked out of a room or kicked off of it, fired from an administration or any number of things that it shouldn't be that easy because you're feeling unsafe. Mm-hmm. We live in very insane making times.
Yes.
And I talk a lot about this lately all the time. Basically, it's all I ever want to talk about is how worried I am about the mental health of everybody.
Yeah. I see.
Because now that we're all, but now that we're all locked up and like, this is the worst place to, if you aren't feeding your spirit and your soul and you're only on Twitter all day fighting and you're projecting all of your own, because we're all just projecting our own psyches on there. It's so much of it is projecting our own cognitive distortions without even realizing it. And then you're absorbing all of these other cognitive distortions. And now it's just one nightmarish loophole that everybody's really just feeding off everyone else's insanity. And then the world is increasingly reflecting that. And I'm very worried about, you know, it takes me a lot of daily work to, and I was joking about this on Dumpster Fire today. I was saying it takes a lot for me to stay sane. And that is as a loose version of sane. It's as sane as I think I am or might be, but it's not. It's still like, I have an alcoholic brain. I misperceive things. I get insecure. I feel like people don't like me. I have all kinds of, you know, I'm still probably unhealthily addicted to Twitter at times. Mm-hmm. We think we're stronger than the algorithm. We're not. it is feeding us dopamine all day long.
The smartest brains in the world are working on how to keep you glued to the internet.
Yeah. Yeah.
And addicted to foods. So it's good. It's good to know why that's where the brain power is going.
So yeah, I made that kind of conscious decision knowing that I'm not a victim. You know, when people, I try very hard to, I know now, and this is also why it's very important for me to be sober. I don't question if I tweeted something when I was stoned, or should I have said that? You know, I don't have any doubt. I have to be clear and know that I'm in the Thunderdome and that I'm standing in the Coliseum or wherever, and that I have made myself as mentally sound as I possibly can. And when I start getting agitated, I just log off. And if they're, you know, it does get to a point where I wrote a piece about it that's going around right now, actually, about how Twitter, you know, I had this crazy dream where I was sitting with future Bridget on her deathbed, and she was asking me about how I felt about my time spent on Twitter. And Zuby, I have not been the same since.
That's hilarious.
I just haven't.
That's hilarious. Twitter is amazing, though. If you use
it is. It's an amazing tool, and it can be. And I've met you and so many people. I should have just named my podcast "All of My Friends Are from Twitter" because that's basically what it is. But it can also be a supremely negative addiction for many people.
You really have to, you know, I say you have to use the tool, not let the tool use you.
Mm-hmm.
And there's always going to be a bit of trade-off. It might vary from day to day and hour to hour. But I think that, you know, way too many people on social media in general are just sort of mindlessly scrolling and consuming without any sort of self-awareness or thought of what they're doing and what the potential impact and, you know, repercussions of it are. Because, you know, we're living in the biggest human experiment ever right now. I mean, the past 15 years.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not supposed to be able to. Why can we reach hundreds of thousands of people from our, like, from tapping buttons? That's not human. Like, we're not meant to be able to do that. Like, that's insane. Hundreds of thousands of people, millions of people are not supposed to be able to, you know, the fact anybody, literally anybody can reach you, can reach me. Like, that's what's cool. But also, it's like, that's not meant to be the case. I get some message. I'm like, you shouldn't even be able to reach me. Do you know what I mean? Like, you know what I mean? Like, like, why can you even reach me? Sort of thing. Like, who are you? Like, what is this?
I got one of those today where I was like, dude,
just one? Like, lucky.
Well, I get them all day, but this one was like, I'm not subscribing because you aren't interacting enough. I'm like, it's.
And then people start telling you what to do, and, you know, tell you what to do.
I think that's a product of being open too. If you're super open about your experience and your journey, people think that they kind of own you in a weird way.
That's weird.
And it is a very strange, suddenly people get very demanding of your time and attention, and notice things that I'm like, wow, read into things that I might be doing or not doing that have, you know, when I got sober, one of the things, and I still remind myself this all the time, it's not about me. Mm-hmm. You know, it's very easy to get, but I'm like, oh, wow, a lot of other people are struggling with the same concept. Like, it's not, don't take it personally. You know, it's one of those four agreements. Like, don't take everything personally.
Mm.
And that's, I have to remind myself of that, but I can see that some of the people who follow me might need to be reminded of that as well.
Oh, seriously. Yeah. It's a very strange dynamic. I mean, I'm lucky that, you know, firstly, I'm like a super, super, like, low emotional person, which certainly helps, but also from my music. So from, like, you know, when I released my first album at 19, and then from then onwards, I've been facing public scrutiny and criticism for, like, well over a decade. So I've kind of built up that tough skin up to an exoskeleton from that. And then all my years just going out and promoting and hustling on the street and doing direct sales and all of that. It's like, I get a lot of people like, man, how do you deal with all the online stuff? I'm like, dude, I'm bulletproof at this point. You know, like, there's nothing anyone can sort of say or whatever that's going to, like, majorly rattle me. There are certain things that just make me kind of feel, like, sad for people. Like, nothing rattles me directly. But some stuff I read and I'm like, well, what possesses somebody to, like, write this? You know, why?
I know.
Like, I just sort of lament for humanity in a way.
I get that.
Yeah. Like, what's going on here?
I'm pretty bulletproof. I won't say that things don't affect me. Mm. And Malice always calls me out on this. He's like, it's because you're too empathetic. And maybe that is the weakness or something. But I too have that moment where somebody will say something just horrific to me. And I'm like, wow, what? I pray for them. Yeah, you know, it sounds stupid and cliche, but I have to, as easy as it would be to react, mm-hmm. really my first instinct is just sadness because I see so much pain in that kind of, I can't imagine logging in and saying some of the things that people say mm-hmm. anonymously or not. Mm-hmm. It's just not. And maybe it's just because I was a product of so much bullying growing up, but it's just not in me to be that. I'm sure I have it in me to be cruel. I know that all humans do. I don't think that I don't have that capacity, but just those, I don't know. I just, it seems crazy to me that that's how you would spend your time.
I'm the same. All. You know, there's people just every day. I'm just like, man, there's people who there's millions of people around the world who log in every day on Twitter, on YouTube, on it, and they just start hating. Like, they're just, like this is their goal. Like, I'm just like, man, I mean, you know, I've spent 0 minutes in my entire life doing that, or, you know, let me go watch a whole bunch of YouTube videos I don't like so that I can dislike them and write mean comments and aggravate, you know, I get. Do you get like personal emails sometimes? Like, you know, I'll get people sending me an essay to explain how much they dislike me.
And it's just,
no, normally not in the kindest of words. Yeah. It's just incredible. I'm like, okay, so you heard me on the radio and I said something on the radio that you didn't like. So your first thought was, okay, I'm going to find this guy's email address and I'm going to write like a long screed to like cuss him out and insult him and all. And I'm just like, this is you to do that. That's the last thing. I hear stuff I disagree with every single day. And at no point have I gone, let me find this person's email address and like spend an hour. It's such an odd mentality. I don't get it.
I've joked about this even just with, you know, I see women dating men and they'll be like, he liked this girl's Instagram. And it's really occurred to me that I'm way too narcissistic to stalk anyone. I'm like, wow. You actually spend time like that. I'm way too and driven and probably too. I'm just too focused on my own stuff to be spending time like like that. You know, like checking what some dude is like, what he's liking.
Yeah, I mean, Bridget, I think you once liked a tweet that I disagree with. So we're actually doing this podcast because I want to formally cancel you.
This is really just an intervention.
It's so odd. I've had people like message me, hey, how come you like that tweet?
I'm the creeping of the likes is I've had people, I didn't even know this was a thing until people started being like, she's telling on herself and her likes all day, but I like everything. I mean, I like stuff from the left, from the right. I'm like, if you look my likes, you would think I was a schizophrenic because I just love giving, because to me, I'm like, I love giving out love. I see it as a way of being loving online. Yeah. So I just am like, I like everything.
I often use it just to acknowledge that I've read something.
I just,
or just like an acknowledgement. Okay. Yeah, I read this.
But I can't imagine spending time looking at what anyone else likes. Again, maybe it's narcissism, maybe it's self-involvement, maybe it's drive.
I think it's actually a good thing. I don't think you need to make excuses for it. I think the people who do it are the ones who need to explain themselves.
Like, what? Yeah. What are you doing?
Yeah,
and
weird.
You're reading into it too, which is a weird thing. So you're now mind reading.
Oh gosh, yeah.
And intention, which happens a lot. Mm-hmm. And this is a thing that we see constantly of this mind reading someone's intention and assuming the worst.
Oh, yes.
Which is another thing I don't understand, really. Why would you just jump to assume? I mean, I understand worst case scenario thinking, I'm an addict. So that like going from A to doom is easy for me to do. But I try very hard not to assume the worst intentions of everyone, even people who would happily destroy me.
yeah. Do you find you make a lot of enemies, or do you think that people are more just kind of being silly?
I think that there are a lot of people who, you know, I I think this is the biggest thing that I wrestle with, is that the road to hell is paved with good intentions. I don't want to hurt anyone. You know, I can push back. You and I both are in this same space for many of the similar reasons. And I can push back against some of the craziness around, for example, that comes from trans activists in particular, mm-hmm. but I don't want to hurt the trans community, you know? Sure. So how do you get put in this position where it's like, well, yeah, I want to push back against some of this craziness that you see in the ideology, mm-hmm. but I don't want to hurt actual vulnerable communities. And I worry a lot that I am, whether mm-hmm. I'm trying to or not. And it's not my intention to, but
I think you're a better person than me.
you don't worry.
No, I you know what it is? It's like with me, I know what's in my heart and I know what my intentions are. And I know that I have no hatred for any individual or group. Right.
Yeah.
So given that I know that, I've kind of just reached the stage where like, look, I'm not going to sugarcoat things because of the potentiality of possibly offending someone or someone wanting to choose to pretend to be offended by something I did or said because they're doing mind reading, as you said, or they're coming up with the worst possible view of why I'm saying that. Because it's like, look, I think I speak very clearly and concisely, and you know what I say is what I mean, right? So
right.
If I say something and if someone is like, oh, you know, like if I post, of course, I had my viral deadlift tweet or whatever, and right, and if someone is like, oh, he's posting this because he hates trans people, and I'm like, no, do you know what I mean? Like, I'm not even going to spend huge amounts of time like defending myself and explaining and whatever. I'm just like, no, right? That's not even. You've got zero evidence for that. You're just trying to drag me into the silly game so that I go on the defensive and start like, yo, I'm sorry, I didn't mean. I was like, no, I'm not apologizing for anything. I'm not like, I'm just, I did what I did. I said what I said. I made the point, and that's that, you know? And once you have a large audience, the reality is that people are always some people will misunderstand you sort of innocently, right? They'll genuinely misunderstand you. But there are a lot of people out there who don't have good intentions, right?
No.
A lot of people do not have good intentions, and they are trying to, you know, get you to bow or to twist your words in a malicious way or to do this or to do that. And I'm just like, look, like, you guys can play your game. I'm just going to do what I do, keep it real. And if you genuinely don't understand something, I'm happy to explain it.
Yeah.
But if you're going to do this disingenuous thing, then whatever.
I think part of it comes from I don't want to become that which I criticize. So sure. I don't necessarily want to become the person who is just generalizing about large groups of people because they might share an ideology. Mm-hmm. And I try to take people individually. That's one of my, I guess, not hesitations, but where that feeling of worry. The yeah. other is I've had my ass, pardon me, handed to me, my bum handed to me by life. I have been humbled by many circumstances in which I thought perhaps I was doing the right thing and it went a different way because I can't control everything. Or so even if my intentions were good, it is that very famous quote. So I know it's in my heart. I love people deeply. I feel sad for humans generally, as we were talking about, when they're that angry, you know, that much. I have been that person who is trapped in victimhood. Mm-hmm. And some of the things that happened to me, I was a victim. That doesn't mean that I have to embrace victimhood as mm-hmm. my identity. Mm-hmm. And that's taken a lot of therapy, sobriety, and self-work to get to that point. And I still have to weed out places where I might feel entitlement was another big one.
Yeah.
Just rooting out entitlement mm-hmm. in places that it didn't belong. So I think being brought to my knees by life as many times as I have been has given me a perspective that I look at men like you and people in this space who don't seem to have any of that self-doubt, I guess, that I do feel I have. I feel sometimes, and I think that it could be just the product of me being so wrong so many times.
Sure.
You know, so I've failed greatly in my life already.
Yeah.
And I have learned that I don't really always know where these people are coming from, but I do know that in my past, when I've lashed out and been not my very best person, that it's usually come from pain and hurt. And sure. So I don't want to contribute to that, but I also won't be a doormat.
Yeah. It's a difficult balance. I mean,
yeah.
To what degree do you feel that you're sort of, I mean, because you are a public figure to some degree now, how much sort of responsibility do you feel to help people, I guess, in that sense? Do you feel that that's sort of something you're obliged to do or not so much?
I feel a responsibility, you know, I don't feel responsible for, it's really none of my business what people think of me.
Sure.
This is very basic therapy 101. I don't feel responsible for the way people react to me either, because so much of it is being filtered through their own factory settings and I have no control over that. Mm-hmm. I'm powerless over pretty much everything and everyone other than my own behavior. So I do feel a responsibility to behave in ways in which I would expect other people to behave. I always try and tell my, you know, following, I'm not responsible for what they do, who they follow, what they like. I don't want them to mob people. Yeah. You know, if somebody comes after me, I've learned this the hard way. Just even I had a comedian friend and he responded to me and I responded back to him and I didn't realize people were looking at even my responses.
Mm-hmm. And it's weird.
Because when you grow fast too, I still have the mentality of somebody with 10,000 followers or 20, totally. And it's different. Some things happen where it's a learning curve and I'm like, whoa, this poor person is getting mobbed and made fun of and mocked by all of these people. And I don't want that. Mm-hmm. I don't want people to do that. And so much of Twitter is that. Yeah, and I've done that. I do that to people who are bigger than me. You know, I'll like go after AOC and make jokes about her. But she can take it. I feel like if you're in the, you know, that's the thing is if you are in this space, you've got to be able to take it. And if I'm dishing it out and get it back from one of these people who's much bigger than me, well, okay. I learned that lesson when I had 200 followers and Dane Cook retweeted me and I had 3 days of like his idiot followers telling me that I was ugly and I'm an idiot. Uh-oh. And I was like, I'm not going to get mad. I told him that he was bad, that he sucked at comedy.
Yeah, it's a funny one. The power dynamic on social media is a weird thing. It's a weird thing. And that's something I've had to be really, really like you said, there've been a lot of learning moments for me because, you know, I'm far less sympathetic than you are, I think. So sometimes I don't care if, you know, there's certain things if someone said, I'm like, look, you deserve to get hammered. I don't care. But like sometimes there have been ones where it's like, oh, wow, did I just sort of, you know, kill an ant with a flamethrower sort of thing? You know, where like, this has happened multiple times where like the person ends up deleting their whole account. Right.
Oh,
they say something ridiculous to me and, you know, my followers are ride or die. Like I've got some followers, like they will, like if someone disses me, like they will go so hard at them. And I've had ones where it's like, whoa, that whole person just like deleted their entire, like, didn't they just protect it? Like they're just off Twitter now. And I was like, oh, okay. That wasn't my intention.
Yeah.
You know, but at the same time, I'm kind of like, I don't know. Like there are lots of things now, which I won't. Like I'm just like, you know what? I'm not going to respond to that because the reaction, not from me, but the response like in general could just be overkill. And it's like, okay, like they get the point. You don't need to keep beating them into submission, you know?
And I think that's why when you get to the point of Rogan or, you know, I still don't think that people will joke and they're like, you're famous. I'm like, no, I'm not. Like, your mom doesn't know my name. I'm not famous until your mom knows who I am.
Yeah.
Somebody introduced me once in DC as a Twitter celebrity. And as much as that made me want to take my life immediately, it's the truth, you know, it's a hard pill to swallow, but that is where Twitter gave me wings in many respects. And it's one of the amazing things is that if you can kind of break through, but it's not, I don't see myself as, I actually kind of love where I am right now. Mm-hmm. It's like still not powerful enough that I'm really making any waves or making any difference, but I have a really fun audience. Mm-hmm. And so I don't have any cultural impact like Candace Owens or AOC, you know, people who have these massive followings and really kind of move the needle. Mm. I'm not moving any needles. I'm just boiling away down in the mud, having fun.
I'll tell you what, I can guarantee you that you have more impact than you think you do.
Maybe, but I'm enjoying not being big enough that anyone cares.
Yeah, no, I get what you mean. I mean, this is something I've learned online is however many people who you think know you or have heard of you or whatever, it's going to be multiple times more than that. The reality will be multiple times more. So even your follower count, right? You've probably got like three times as many people who sort of follow your account than actually follow you in terms of people who like regularly
hate me.
Yeah. Or, you know, you have people who just don't use Twitter. And they like they use it, but they're not like they don't have an account, but they go on there and they look at stuff. And you have people who use lists so that they don't follow people, etc. I mean, I really realized this in two things. When I went out to the US last year, that was a big one, because in every single city I was in, I was like I just had people recognize me off of social media or whatever.
Wow.
And then also when I got temporarily suspended for the OK Dude thing. Like that was when I realized, like, both on the positive, on the negative, because there are a lot of people who, like, obviously, like, there are millions of people on Twitter who know who I am. And, you know, some of them are fans, some of them are followers. A lot of them really don't. Like, this is when I realized how many people don't like me. Because when that happened, and because I was locked out, but I could still sort of see what's going on Twitter. And I was like, seeing like the amount of people who were like celebrating. Yes, we took down Zuby. We got Zuby. Like, you know. And I was like, oh wow, okay. There's like a whole sphere. Like, there are a whole sphere of Twitter who like are totally aware of who I am, and like they don't follow me obviously because they don't like me. But like I was just reading all of this stuff. Like, whoa, this is kind of deep, you know?
The meetings are on Tuesday.
Dude, and they have such effed up views of what you believe, you know?
Yeah.
You're there, people are saying, oh, this guy, he's transphobic. He's, you know, he allies with white supremacists. He's a misogynist. He hates women. I'm like, where did you get all of this from? You know what I mean? You got all of this from, like, you know, I tweeted a deadlift and so now I hate this whole group of people, or I've got this position, so I've criticized feminism, so now I hate women and I'm a misogynist and I'm this and I'm that. And then people link, oh yeah, I grew up in Saudi Arabia, so I hate gay people and I support, apparently I was reading people saying that I support gay people being executed. I was like, what, where?
Right. Where have I said that?
And it's such like, on one hand, like you don't really care, but on the other hand, I'm like, these are real big charges. You know what I mean? Like,
no, like,
that's a really messed up thing. Yeah, that's a really messed up thing that you think I believe. Right? Yeah, because I don't, you know.
I mean, you would have to be a sociopath not to have that penetrate in some way. You know, to not have that be upsetting. I've told this story before. I woke up, I tweeted something about how I was like, I'm not going to get on board with this war on white men, and then I just hit the wrong space at the wrong time, and Black Twitter came for me.
Oh,
and
boy.
some of the people are comedians and that I know. And I was so upset. I mean, it was, I still get kind of choked up because they were all like, "You're a grand wizard." And I was like, "What?"
It's bizarre.
It was so upsetting to me. I still get upset about it because it is such a, like, that was the worst thing you could be called, you know, when growing up. I'm like, oh my God, and just garbage. Everybody calling me garbage. I was like, oh my God, I didn't even mean to. It was so misrepresented.
Yeah. But, you know, it's like, see, this is the thing. A lot of those people, like, I think people are too charitable towards them. Like, I know
I've gotten to the point where I'm starting to think that might be true because they would not, they don't extend the same charity to me.
No. Cause look, like what you said there, cause the thing is, what I think is, okay, is what I said morally and ethically right and correct, right? What you said there is morally and ethically correct, right? Mm-hmm. The other day, I don't know if you saw this. I mean, it's a couple weeks. I mean, was it 2 weeks ago when there was that whole Nick Cannon thing and he was talking about white people being subhuman, savages, et cetera. And I was like, no, right? I stood up against racism and I got shellacked. Like, people were like coming at my, you know, virtually were like coming at my throat, you know, trying to say all these things. And I'm like, look, what I said was the correct moral position. Mm-hmm. So if you take issue with me saying, hey guys, it's not good to be racist to white people, if you take issue with that, you're the one in the wrong, right? Yeah, you're the one who's coming from the bad place.
Right. But if you in your brain believe that it is impossible for racism to go in that direction,
that in itself is insidious.
Right. It's that, you know? Well, I mean, that's a critical theory, though, is that it's all power. Every relationship and every interaction is based on power, which to me is such a cynical view of the world.
Mm-hmm. Well, number one, it's wrong. Like, definition, like in terms of an actual definition, firstly, it's just incorrect. It's wrong. Mm-hmm. That's not what the definition of racism is. And secondly, that idea doesn't come from a good place. Mm-hmm. You know, that doesn't come from a moral place, because whatever you call the term, even if you don't want to use the term racism, hating or mistreating or being prejudiced or discriminating against someone based on an immutable characteristic is wrong. Just it's ethically wrong. So even if you don't want to use the term racism, I'm like, well, it's the same thing. It's racial hatred. Call it racial hatred. It's like, that's a bad thing. Hatred is hatred. Like, we know that that's bad. So if you are angry at me for saying, no, that's bad, then, you know, it's like, if I say something, I don't know, if I said something about, you know, people abusing children being bad, and then you want to come after me for saying it, then I'm not in the wrong. I'm not, you know what I mean? Like, I'm not the one who's in the wrong here. You're the one who's got the messed up position. If you think it's okay to hate on people and call them subhuman based on their race or ethnicity, I'm not apologizing to you.
Right.
You're the one who's messed up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was definitely a learning experience. And it was upsetting for sure.
I like you, Bridget. I like you. You're canceled, but I like you.
I'm so good. That's the other thing too with Dumpster Fire. We just, you know, there's so many things because the podcast I have is much more heady and deep and intellectual, and we get into these deeper conversations. Dumpster Fire is really just my Twitter come to life. And I say things that if you took them out of context, you'd be, you know, I'd be canceled in 5 seconds. And I think if you can break through, you know, get that escape velocity, which I feel like I'm on my way to, I still live in constant fear because I was poor for so long. Mm. But I think they kind of give up on people like me.
Yeah.
You know, what are they going to take from me?
Yeah.
I don't have a job that they can, I'm not working. I'm not running for office. There's nothing. I'm really just existing in my own little world, kind of. So,
people really need to just, everybody, I wish everybody would just stop bending the knee to these people. And that's the thing, like, and again, it's because what I find jarring is, like, I think, again, I just think so many people are too charitable. Like, I think people who are more like on the more right leaning, more conservatives, et cetera, it's like, we've been dealing with these people for so long that, you know, like, you know that, like, yeah, sure, there are some people who are sort of pro-social, you know, social justice, et cetera. And I know, okay, you can tell it comes from a good, decent place, but when it comes from, oh, okay, look, if you're trying to destroy somebody's life and career and income because you disagree with them, you are not the good guy.
Right.
Period.
Yeah, that I think that's been something guy. That I've realized too, just the, you know, even just I tell this story all the time about how I went on Glenn Beck and I was like, did you know they have double standards on the left? It's like, yeah, Bridget. We're aware of that. Like they apply their rules to unequally. And he's like, yeah. So just, I think, having more conversations with conservatives and I'll say something and they'll be like, yeah, no kidding. You know, we've been dealing with this. So there is some of that I realize has just been there for a long time. And I was just completely oblivious to it.
Sure.
And then I think there's, you know, you and I and anyone at this point gets called a grifter often. And
oh, how's that going, by the way?
The grifting?
Yeah, the grift.
Good. The grift is strong in this one.
This has to be one of the most misused terms online. It's just like anything and everything. It's like,
I don't even understand it. Like, okay, hey, if I'm a grifter, I'm really bad at it because I'm not making, like, I'm not rolling in the cash over here. And B, I don't think people know what grifter means.
No, they really don't. Like, I've seen the word just used. I'm like, that is totally like a grifting is like conning. It's like a swindling or conning. That's what it means. So if I say like I'm selling some weight loss tablet and it doesn't work and I'm there like making up false claims and whatever and I'm shilling it and making money, that's grifting, right? Like swindling, conning people. It's not having a view that somebody disagrees with. It's not just making money online. Like I got called a grifter for selling my book. I'm like, wow. I wrote a fitness book. I sell my book. So that's not making money online is not grifting. Like, that's not what it means. Like,
I think I get called it because it's like, oh, she came from the left and now she's friends with all these right wing people and she's a grifter. Mm. But what am I grifting? I'm still just speaking my truth.
And
it only works in one
direction.
I'm grifting the truth.
Yeah.
I'm grifting my truth. Yeah. It's just weird.
Yeah. But then you have people who like make a whole living off of like selling this nonsense. And you know, you must have heard of Robin DiAngelo, most racist woman in America.
The biggest grifter in America.
Literally the biggest grifter. You know, she charges like is it 12
like
or 15?
$14,000 or something. Yeah.
Per talk. She's earning like six figures a month and literally.
They're coming for her though. Did you see that?
Oh, are they? I haven't actually seen that.
She got too big.
I haven't actually seen that.
She got too big. She should have just laid low, kept that grifting money on the DL.
Oh my gosh, man.
They were like, she posted a picture on Instagram of her vacation in Vermont and she was with all white people. And they were like, yeah, so they're coming for her.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
She got too big.
You can't win. You just can't win in this. The only way you win is by just not playing this game because you're always going to get outflanked in wokeness. Like it doesn't matter.
No.
Where do you think this is all going? Do you think things are, I mean, you're in the States. I'm seeing from over the pond, it looks like the whole country is on fire right now. I know it's not, but
because it literally is. No, okay. It's not. It's funny. Somebody posted I have yet to watch it, but I saw you did an interview in the locals community and fetacy.com. They posted your interview with Brett.
Okay.
And yeah, I guess you were talking about what the view is like from across the pond.
Yeah.
I still have to watch it because I'm very interested in your perspective. From my perspective in LA, but I've been saying this for years before any of this kind of unrest and whatever. I was saying 2 years ago, it was very hot. There was tons of homelessness. And it has a little bit of a pre prequel to the apocalypse vibe, you know, like the right before the apocalypse. I feel like we're in like Vias for Vendetta, you know, like that moment right before everything starts going. But I'm not really sure. On my bad days, I think it varies from day to day. Mm. And a lot of it depends on what level of nihilism or optimism I'm feeling. And on my bad days, I'm like, Glenn, back in the bunker, get your bully on and get ready for the Civil War.
Yeah.
And on my good days, I'm no. I think I'm not really sure how this marble is going to roll, but I don't see it rolling. I understand why everyone's getting out of big cities. Let's just say that. Yeah. Because when there's unrest like this and you live in a place that's not really well fortified, it is terrifying. Sure. And you're not really sure what mobs of people have always scared me in general. Mm-hmm. And it just seems like there's a mentality of there's a lot. I did like what Chappelle was saying, where he was like, these are the streets talking, because I do think there is a certain amount of, I mean, a lot of people have been fed nonsense about how bad they have it. Sure. And also it's not great. You know, a lot of people are struggling in America. Mm-hmm. People are $400 away from being broke. People mm-hmm. they don't have great health care. They are terrified all the time. They're trying to make ends meet. Now we've shut everything down and taken away their livelihood. And the whole thing is a recipe for, there's been so much divisiveness from the right and the left. The rhetoric has been horrific. For 4 years, really. And so I don't really see.
Well, it's been longer than four, but yeah.
Well, yeah, but the past four have been particularly, I feel like they've been very ramped up. Mm. It spilled out. 4 years ago, it wasn't affecting, like it wasn't on Nextdoor. It wasn't affecting people at barbecues. You know, there was still some politics weren't infecting literally every moment of our lives.
Mm. I think 2014 is when stuff really went sideways, in my observation.
Interesting. Yeah. Why 2014?
That's how, I mean, because, I mean, remember, I mean, in 2015, even being over here in the UK, I mean, I remember very specifically in 2015 where... All right. I remember when I remember before Trump won the Republican nomination, and I was talking with friends and family, and people were laughing at me for saying this guy had a serious chance of winning.
Oh, yeah. Like, I knew he was going to win.
Yeah. And people were like, no. And it was because I'd seen this shift that in the culture that from, I do want to say 2014 is when it just started to like a lot of this weird stuff. I think a lot of stuff has been coming to a head over the last 1 to 2 years. But like 2014 was when I myself was kind of like, there's a weird schism and a rift going on here. And a lot of these weird previously fringe ideas, whether it's, you know, the racial identitarianism stuff, the critical theory stuff, like the gender stuff, all of this stuff was just like, I started seeing it seeping in quite rapidly. And I was like, okay, there's going to be a reactionary response to this. And I thought that a lot of why Trump won. Some people are like, oh, it was just simply economics. I'm like, no, it wasn't. There's a big cultural aspect to it because people see Trump as like a bulwark against some of the madness. Some people think he's the source of the madness. And I can understand that. But I'm like, no, like to people who are in support of him, he's like the bulwark from this stuff just going like really, really hard.
Yeah, he doesn't put up with it.
Yeah.
Yeah. They see him as a hero. And yeah, that's right. I think probably... That's why I knew he was going to win as well, because I stumbled into the culture wars in 2015.
Okay, yeah. Okay.
And it was when I was realizing that this stuff was everywhere.
Yeah.
So, but I think since he won, you know, since he kind of came down that escalator, the rhetoric has just, it's been, Yeah, it's been taken up to 11. Yeah. And I do feel like our culture is approaching a bit of a rock bottom. And okay, we might just need to bottom out in order to rebuild. Because I have no idea. It's really, I don't know whether I'm going to be on the front lines of some civil war in December, or I'm going to be sitting on my couch watching Netflix, or I'm going to be roasting rats over an oil dump. You know, it could be, really could go any one of the ways.
The UK is going to be taking refugees from the US.
I hope so, but you guys have some messed up stuff over there too.
We do, but America does everything 10 times harder. Everything,
yeah, but you guys harder. Are the canary in the coal mine.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. Like,
there's a lot of weird Orwellian stuff over there. There you guys is. Don't yeah, even there have is. Free speech.
Yeah, there is. It's strange. It's strange. I don't know. The modern Western world is, it's bizarre because it's really weird. And I think it's quite deranging because things are, in many ways, by most measures that you'd measure a society, things are better than they've ever been.
I know.
Right? But
we're like trust fund babies who just don't know what to do with our wealth.
Yeah. And then by other measures, certain things are like really bad compared to where they've been over the past few decades, depending on what you're looking at. And then there's also people who want to, we live in the age of feelings and the age of narrative, right? And even though things are so good, people are insisting that they're worse than ever, right? There's never been more talk in my life, my entire lifetime, I've never heard so many people talking about white supremacy and racism and Nazis and fascists. And I'm like, where? Do you know what I mean? Like, where are all these white supremacists? Have you ever met a fascist? I haven't. I hear about fascists all the time. I've never met a fascist. Like, I've met a lot. I've met socialists. I've met conservatives, liberals.
I mean, you met one today, Zuby.
Oh, geez. Canceled. Yeah. I'll have to call my Antifa friends.
According to Twitter, you met one right now.
Okay. We'll have to dox you and they'll come with the milkshakes.
Yep.
I mean, what's going on in Portland, Bridget? Tell me. I don't understand.
Oh, my gosh.
Like, what is going on?
Really looking back, it was the natural evolution. You know, I have kind of a weird theory that I've been playing out in my brain. That it doesn't seem like an accident to me that a lot of this is happening with the rise of the legalization of marijuana.
Oh, okay.
And that is probably a wildly unpopular theory, but I think that weed can make you really aggressive and really dumb. And I see a lot of really aggressive dumbness out there.
Yeah.
So I have no science to back this up. This is just a theory that I'm working on. I started working on it on my walk yesterday, just cause I was thinking about, Portland, you know, I'm like, they're all just so high up there. They're just bored.
I thought I was supposed
to
chill people out. That's what I
thought.
No, the
weed
never
is so strong. This is what everybody's saying. Oh. Everyone says like, oh, it's supposed to chill you out depending on the strain. But in the past decade of when I was smoking, I remember going to Coachella one year and I kept calling it Agrochella because I was like, what is everyone smoking that they're so aggressive?
Really?
And it's been pumped up with all kinds of stuff. And it's been, you know, they have managed to perfect this, the art of growing this, but they've taken all this, you know, they've pumped it up. It's all steroids and fertilizers and all kinds of crazy teas with back guano. And
wow.
But I do think there's a lot of weird, maybe it's just heightening the already, you know, I think at the root of it all, it's a class war, really, what we're seeing. It's just there's so much access to envy. You know, we have so much envy with Instagram, and you're always seeing everyone who's doing better than you, and you're not really seeing the real person behind a lot of these personas. And then you have people who are idiots like David Geffen posting, you know, drone shots from their yacht in quarantine. Oh, and you're like, Read the room, David. Read the room. You know, the pitchforks are coming for you.
Yeah,
but
I don't know. The people with the pitchforks seem to be pretty rich from what I can see.
A lot of them are. But they don't.
This is the irony.
But they've told themselves they're not.
Yeah, it's really weird. Like, I've never seen such privileged, oppressed people ever.
I know, it's crazy. This is why I think it's the weed, because it's you're really just delusional weird. And crazy.
Yeah.
It's making people crazy.
Okay. So the message of the story, the moral of the story, don't do drugs.
Don't do drugs, kids, or you'll end up like Portland.
Awesome. Bridget, where can people find you online?
You can find me at Bridget Fetisi on Twitter and Instagram, and you can find me at fetisi.com. We have a lovely community. It's an oasis of free speech and just chillaxness. We do workout videos and talk about cooking post. It's so soothing. It's just nice. I love it there.
Nice.
And and you can find me on YouTube at The Dumpster Fire, or Fetisi is the channel, and podcast is Walk-Ins Welcome, which you've been on.
I have. I had to return the favor. Bridget, thank you so much for coming on the Real Talk with Zuby podcast.
Thank you for having me. It's so fun.
Awesome.
I am the man, sick with the slang, sick and I'm destined for fame. Do for the fam, not for the grand, stunt me, you're destined for pain. I do not front, I do not scam, put some respect on my name. Sick like Cobain, click and I bang. Y'all gon' remember the name. Y'all gon' remember the name.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5HETIDE.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5HETIDE.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.